Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, why you should plan a dinner party around death. Yes, today is Halloween, but this is not about that. We'll spend the hour with Michael Hebb, who has helped tens of thousands of people plan dinner parties to talk with friends and family about this most taboo and most universal subject. We'll learn why people find these parties so meaningful, talk about some possible conversation starters around the table, and we'll discuss a couple of things Hebb says we should avoid doing. One is forcing somebody who's not ready to join the party. Another is relying on euphemisms for death and dying. Our conversation starts after a short break. Let's start today with a little straight talk, shall we? You are going to die. I am going to die. Everyone we've ever known and loved, all of us, will eventually cease to exist as physical beings. We all get this, right? At least intellectually. But we're susceptible to a kind of magical thinking that says if we don't talk about death, maybe it won't happen. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The thing is, death is as universal a human experience as breathing. And before we ourselves are close to dying, just about all of us will mourn the loss of loved ones. If most of us won't ever quite shake the fear of our own demise, we can get comfortable talking about it. My guest's simple but radical idea? Make it a topic at dinner. Michael Hebb is founder of Death Over Dinner and the organization Convivium. His book is called Let's Talk About Death Over Dinner, an invitation and guide to life's most important conversation. He joins us from the studios of NPR in New York. Michael, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. It's great to be here.
So I actually love this idea, but I spend my work days having conversations about things that are often tough to talk about. How did you become convinced that people need to talk about death but don't know how to get started?
Well, you know, I wasn't convinced when we started. I had a hunch that this work could reach a large audience. But it started as a very humble project at the University of Washington in a graduate school program that I was teaching. And I've been bringing people together around the dinner table for the last 20 years. And I made a decision to use the table. And in a kind of a strange decision, I decided it was going to be my medium as an artist and an activist. And so I have spent a lot of time around a lot of difficult conversations with a lot of people, a lot of world leaders and artists and incredibly diverse communities as well. And I knew that I wanted to create a platform that could scale, because the beauty and the difficulty of dinner is it's very finite. You know, the dinner table has very, very clear edges. And so I started looking for a topic that I felt could, you know, that we all have in common, that would get people's attention, and that the conversation about could immediately and in, you know, in a more long and enduring way impact anyone's life who has this conversation. And so that's how we landed on death. Long story short.
The fact that we don't even use the word death as often as we could. We go for euphemisms like passed away or went to heaven. What do those say about our ability to accept death?
I mean, I think they tell a pretty clear story that we have a hard time. And I have a lot of compassion. This is not... there's not really even a should in my work or in this book. And that's why I phrase it as an invitation. It's for people that are ready, for people that are magnetized towards this conversation. But it makes a lot of sense to me why death is not a common topic and why we do have euphemisms. It's, you know, it's within our neurological cognitive bias. Like, it's within our brains that we wouldn't naturally just bring it up, like what we ate last night or what we plan on watching, you know, on Netflix this evening. So we have these cognitive biases. One of them is that we somehow, as you mentioned, have this magical thinking that we're going to be an exception to the universe's rules. And thank God, I think romantic love wouldn't be as popular if we didn't think that we'd be an
Eternity exception. Is a long time, right?
Yeah, totally. So it's, you know, and then as a culture, we've distanced ourselves in some way, mercifully, from an encounter with death. We're not around bodies, and we're not around our dead loved ones as much. We've professionalized and medicalized, or attempted to do, you know, medicalized death. And so what happens is we lose a touchstone, an encounter with it that we've had for a very long time. And so a lot of my work is to say, well, we die differently. It's not in our regular day-to-day existence. So what are beautiful, meaningful ways that we could reintroduce this conversation? Because as you mentioned, none of us are getting out of here alive. So we might as well figure out the best or some good ways to engage around this topic and learn the things that we can from death.
So you said there aren't a lot of shoulds in this work, but you do have one rule, which is that we really should not ambush somebody and force them into a conversation that they just aren't ready to handle.
Yeah, it's, you know, I like to say it doesn't work if you are inviting people to pizza night and surprise, it's a death dinner. or Thanksgiving.
People
say, Thanksgiving. Yeah. Yeah, like Thanksgiving is a perfect time to have a death dinner. And it's like, well, yeah, it might be. But you have to ask for the consent of your family. Consent is key in this conversation. But it's also, a lot of people take their first rejection or the fear of rejection around this conversation very seriously. And so a lot of conversations don't happen because people, you know, get shut down or think that it will be too intense a topic for their parents. And so they don't even try.
I would think it would be easier for people to start with friends rather than family having these conversations.
I couldn't agree more. And actually, it took me 5 years of doing these dinners before I asked my mother and my brother to have one of them with me. And, you know, I mean, I think they felt a little left out, quite frankly. Like, oh, yeah, you're the death guy, but you don't come around here with that. And so I understand how difficult it is. But the thing is, starting with friends is a great idea, and you'll get to know your friends better than any activity I've ever seen, and in a quicker fashion. And also coworkers. Sounds like a strange thing for coworkers to do together. But, it you know, talk about a team-building activity. you know, practice. And then, but some people go right into it. They go right into the deep end of having the conversation with their loved ones. And the thing is, those are the people you really want to have this conversation with. You really want to know how to advocate and, you know, be a caretaker and be there for your parents or a loved one. If they're in the ICU or if they have a terminal diagnosis, you want to have some literacy and some fluency. And you also want them to know what you want.
You note that people tend to be most reluctant to talk about dying with someone who is dying. And I wonder, is that reluctance that it seems somehow rude to bring this up, or are people honestly afraid that the dying person has not thought about what's ahead?
Well, again, back to another, you know, one of these things, these cognitive biases that are just woven into our brain, we have one where we don't like to make people uncomfortable. And if somebody's dealing with a terminal diagnosis or they've lost somebody recently, we assume that by bringing it up, we're reintroducing the source of their pain and suffering. The reality, what I found, and this is not, again, this is not a you should. This is if you want to deeply connect with somebody or stay in deep connection with somebody who is dealing with a terminal diagnosis or has dealt with a loss, is talk to them about that. They'll let you know if they don't want to talk about it. But what I've found is the majority of the time, is people that have had a brush with death, a very serious one, it's very present for them, and that it, and they really appreciate and are grateful for people in their life that have the courage to stand beside them and talk about something that is painful or scary.
Speaking of courage, you lost your father when you were very young, and nobody really talked to you about it. What was the emotional cost to you of that silence?
Well, it was many things. And he actually passed away on Halloween, of all days. And I don't know that I can't do the quick math, but it's something like 29 years ago. And, you know, I was 13. I didn't tell any of my friends on the day he died or the week following, and you know went out trick or treating as a 13-year-old, and I didn't bring it up with my peer group because I didn't think they could take it, and I didn't want to have to have told them this incredibly intense piece of news and have them fumble it, right? That felt or reject it. And I didn't know how to feel my own pain. And leading up to his death, our family did a, you know, was in a crisis state. But we did, I would say, a not very good job of talking about his, he had Alzheimer's, talking about what was going on and his impending death. And that his time was limited and that he was going to have moments of great clarity and then moments of great obscurity. And that's the nature of Alzheimer's. And I didn't, because we didn't talk openly about it, it became it became shameful conversation, almost like a secret.
Yeah.
And, you know, what happens with secrets and things that we're ashamed of is we avoid them. And I ended up avoiding my father because the whole thing just felt too much or just, you know, shameful. And, you know, I missed the opportunity from the time I was 7 when he was diagnosed to the time he was he died when I was 13. I missed the opportunity to get to know my father as I was becoming, you know, a young adult or, you know, a teenager. And it's one of the only regrets I have.
Do you have any memories of him early on after he was diagnosed trying to have those conversations with you?
To some extent, I remember him trying to connect with me and trying to talk to me about my interests. And I had shut down. I'd gotten scared and shut down on a certain level. But, you know, at first he was quite angry because he didn't know what was happening to him. These were the early days of Alzheimer's. And so it wasn't an accepted phenomenon. And, you know, his brain started eating itself. And he was, you know, slightly violent in the beginning, and that was scary, not towards us, but just in general, this kind of like violent, angry outburst. And so all of that, and no one was there to be like, hey, so that's a stage, and then he's probably going to be quite calm. And, you know, these conversations just, this map, I would say, this roadmap wasn't given to me, and so I felt quite lost.
I think some people are afraid to talk to children about death because they realize they can't answer every single question definitively.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why it's difficult to talk to children. I struggle with it with my daughters. One of them is interested and one of them isn't. And so my golden rule with kids after doing this work for so long and talking to a lot of specialists around and psychologists around children and death is if they are asking questions, meet them there, right? If they're curious and they want to know about, you know, even difficult questions like where does grandmother go? You know, these are things that I think that we can begin to look at with our children and just say, hey, I'm also curious, or this conversation makes me uncomfortable too, but I think that we can think about it together and we can read some books together. And you're alive right now and you're breathing and everybody else in our family is healthy and okay. There are things that you can say if a child has some deep-seated fears.
My guest is Michael Hebb. We're talking about his book, Let's Talk About Death Over Dinner, An Invitation and Guide to Life's Most Important Conversation. We'll come back to this conversation in 2 minutes. You can join us by calling 800-933-5372. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Michael Hebb, who is the founder of Death Over Dinner and the organization Convivium. He has a new book out called Let's Talk About Death Over Dinner, An Invitation and Guide to Life's Most Important Conversation. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERAThink. So much of this book, Michael, is built around prompts for those conversations, and one that caught my attention right away, because it seems like such a perfect sort of manageable gateway question, is what foods do you remember a departed loved one cooking for you? How did you discover that question?
Actually, the background to that question is pretty fun. There's an incredible organization called The Conversation Project, and they... they're very much like Death Over Dinner, and they extend people into these into end of life planning documents. And so we've worked together a lot, the dinner being a great way to begin, and then the Conversation Project gets people really ready on a legal side. And we hosted a week of dinners, and there were like 5,000 dinners that happened during this week in January a few years ago. And in order to give people inspiration for these dinners, we asked some extraordinary chefs, people like Jose Andres or Ina Gartner, the Barefoot Contessa, and several others, to share recipes with us from people that had lost, some people that had died, and recipes and stories, because for one, it's just another access, right? It's another doorway. There isn't one way to talk about death. There's not one way to broach this topic. There's many, and I've attempted with the book, but also with some of the projects that we've built. And that was called The Endless Table, the recipes. And we're about to turn it into a website. It was a book, and now it'll be an interactive website. But I want to give people as many different doors to open. Onto this conversation. So you find the one that resonates, that someone feels comfortable with. This is not a shock and awe campaign. It's meant to be very gentle.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. I want to go to the phones now. We have Stephen on the line in Mountain Springs. Hi, Stephen.
Yes, thank you so much.
Sure.
Wonderful conversation. I've recently lost my wife to ovarian cancer, and during her illness, we talked a great deal with friends and family, and it always seemed to revolve at some point around religion in some way or another, discussions of post-life experience, and kind of the religious subtext was always sort of in the air. And I'm just curious how does that affect your research and your view concerning these topics? We were both not particularly religious or not particularly religious, and it was actually more difficult for us to talk to our friends because they didn't necessarily share our perspective.
Thanks so much for your call, Stephen, and I'm really sorry for the loss of your wife.
Yeah, Stephen, my heart goes out to you. And it's a good question. And a lot of people would assume at these dinners that they lead to conversations of faith, and it's okay if they do. There's no judgment on that. The way that we frame the prompts and the way that the Death Over Dinner script works, so when you go to the website and you decide you want to have a dinner, it will tell you, ask you what your intention is. And then when you identify that, it'll give you a script so you know exactly what to do, with the evening and how to host it and the structure of it, almost like a board game. The way that the questions are set up are for people to make I statements, not to think about what they want for their experience, sometimes in some very practical realities around what happens to your body. What do you want your funeral to look like or your memorial to look like? Or the question about foods and departed loved one cooking. in many ways, we kind of and not even steer away from questions of afterlife, because it does come up in some, and we use the afterlife question occasionally, and it's in the book as well. But I'm more interested in people making I statements about something that somebody can act upon, telling your loved ones or friends something that's very useful for them to know how to honor you. And through that conversation, the beautiful thing that happens is most people realize they're not talking about death at all. They're talking about life. They're talking about their priorities, their goals, the things that matter most to them. And we don't often have an opportunity to have the conversation with our loved ones about the things that we care about, our priorities in life, our goals. We're not, we're not all creating these vision boards together as families. maybe they are in Venice, California, but like it's that activity brings families and friends closer together, has you understand each other, and creates just incredible, bonds and laughter and humor. And obviously when you're in a situation like you were in, Stephen, it's very, very real. There may be some joyful moments in those conversations, but it may be an opportunity to really get in touch with some of the sadness as well.
What do you learn about somebody when you ask what they imagine their funeral will look like?
They're painting a picture for you about themselves. I mean, I'm not a psychologist, so I can't, or like a Jungian or a Freudian, like I can't take it apart like you would a dream and say, oh, you want,
pine box means this and cremation means
that. Yeah, no, I don't. I haven't built that legend yet. But you can certainly hear what's important to them again. Some of their quirks, people want the manager of the Roots, this incredible band, and that's still a really important band in the U.S. and internationally. The manager, Rich Nichols, when he died, he designed a performance piece, a 3-hour show, where down to the minute, everything was planned, and all of the musicians, including Questlove and these incredibly influential American musicians, were given stage direction about what songs and performance art. And, it was an incredibly healing experience for those musicians. Instead of standing at a memorial, not knowing necessarily what to do, because it's hard when we don't have what I like to call grief work. Like, we don't have something to do. It doesn't help us move through the stages of grief.
You have actually already attended your own funeral, so explain to us how that came about.
Oh, man. I always wonder when that question's going to come up. And then people are like, okay, that guy. No, and this was, I did attend my own funeral, and it was not by my own design, I will say that. I was about to turn 40, and the love of my life, the co-founder of Death Over Dinner, Angel Grant and I, and we're still best friends, but we were together at that time, and we'd just broken up, and we were both devastated, and I was very devastated thinking about the fact that I was going to turn 40 alone. And so I quickly sent out an email. I didn't want to really sit in that discomfort of both the lost relationship and this idea of turning 40 alone. And so I sent out an email to about 50 friends and said, SOS, my birthday is coming up in a couple months. I'm going to do something on the northern coast of California. Let me know if you can be there during those dates. And I got 50 RSVPs immediately. Mm-hmm. And, I felt a little less alone. And then a friend, Matt Wiggins, decided to send an email to that whole group and said, hey, Michael's the death guy. Let's go ahead and turn his birthday into his living funeral. And it started as a tongue-in-cheek, we'll see where this goes. People thought it was a great idea. But it got very serious, so serious that there was actually a custom coffin made for the occasion, unbeknownst to me until I was lowered into it. So it was a remarkable experience, and I highly recommend it, quite frankly.
Really?
Yeah. So, again, we don't create opportunities to hear the most important stuff, either from our families or from our friends. And when you open yourself up to the vulnerability of a thing called a living funeral or a living wake, we actually created a whole website around this because these things happen, and we figured we'd give people some guidance. It's livewake.com. But you get to hear, for 3 hours, I got to hear from my friends how and why they loved me, how they remembered us becoming, you know, coming into my life, which was these, that's right, I remember that. No, I didn't recall. And I also got to hear grievances. I got to hear areas where I needed to work on my connection with them, or things that I needed to apologize for. Like, people really got into it. And so if somebody, you know, if you're elderly and you know you're going to go, a lot of people like the idea of when their 80th or 90th or even 70th birthday being like, yeah, I want to be at my own.
Yeah.
Not wait. I don't want the eulogies to just happen when I can't hear them. So it's very powerful. And again, I acknowledge it's on the fringe, and I don't expect it to be a national craze.
Unrelated to your funeral, you called your mother at one point to apologize for some distance that existed between you, and something really surprising happened.
Yeah, well, I had a revelation. My mom and I have struggled a lot, I think, starting with my father's death and then building from there. We've made a lot of efforts, but we still, our connection has been challenging over the years. And then I realized I had a very clear revelation in a meditation one day. And it was that I was going to be there for my mother during her last chapter, as soon as she knew that she wasn't going to be long for this world, it became clear to me that I was going to be the one by her side. And it had always been kind of unspoken and somewhat spoken that my brother would take up a lot of those duties because they're closer. But I had this revelation, and I called her to tell her about it, which I was, you know, that again, that tension about bringing up somebody's death and the discomfort of it, I felt very keenly as I called her. And I was really pleased when it went to her answering machine and really, really, you know, then scared when I saw my phone light up with her name. And I told her, I said, hey, you know, this has become clear to me. Not that you're going to want me there, but I'm there for you.
Hmm.
I'll take care of anything, and I don't want you to have a question mark about what role I'm going to play. You can count on me. And she, of course, or not of course, but she was, you know, we were both crying on the phone. And what happened was she apologized to me about not being there for me in my childhood, for being hard to connect with in general, taking this incredible responsibility where that hasn't been the norm with us. She tends to get defensive. And I saw this whole different thing crack open around the vulnerability that I shared with her. And then it begets more vulnerability. And so we had a really profound heart opening, and it's continued to this day.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I want to go back to the phones now. We have Dan calling from Granbury. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Great show.
Thank you.
My question, and I might have missed some of these comments earlier, about the cognitive disconnect or whatever you referred to them as around not dealing with certain things in certain ways. Since I've been a child, I've noticed it's a cultural thing that some people think that if you talk about it, it makes it happen sooner kind of phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder what yeah. your take on that is and how you approach people who have that place of being stuck.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And so, yeah, what I was referring to are the cognitive biases that are in our brain. And this is based on the work of Nobel Prize-winning psychologist Daniel Kahneman, where he identified that there are these programs that are working in our brain, some for our benefit and some not. And when it comes to death, we have a few of those working in most of our brains. And, you know, one of them is that we think we're an exception. Another is if we haven't experienced something, it's hard for us to, you know, want to talk about it. Like, it's hard for people who haven't experienced the ocean to want to discuss, you know, surfing. And the other thing is that we find it another bias that we find it difficult to make people uncomfortable, and we assume that this conversation will make people uncomfortable. To your point about people, this idea that talking about death quickens it or brings it more into one's life. One way to address that is that now studies have shown that open conversations about end of life and end of life wishes have the opposite effect, and they increase longevity. And they do this a couple of different ways. One is when people are terminal and stage four and at you know, in kind of dire situations and in ICUs, one-third of the time where someone has a conversation about their wishes, they actually see a significant extension of how long they're alive, even if they're in hospice. And I would attribute that to the fact that they're thinking about it, they're scared about it, and they're repressing it, the conversation. If there's not an avenue for an open conversation, that adds extra pressure on an already, you know, on a system, on a body that is already struggling, right? And so there's this liberation. And, you know, we know now that repression creates disease across all topics. The more topics we're repressing, the more of a perfect environment we've created for a long list of diseases. And so there's that. And there's also the fact is we now know the ingredient, the number one ingredient in longevity in general is human connection. It's how deep our community is and how deeply connected we are to our community. And I will tell you from talking about everything on the planet or trying to, every topic imaginable, the conversation about death creates more human connection than anything I've ever encountered.
Michael Hebb is my guest. He's founder of Death Over Dinner and author of a new book called Let's Talk About Death Over Dinner, an invitation and guide to life's most important conversation. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org or go to Twitter and ask a question at @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the founder of Death Over Dinner, Michael Hebb, whose new book is called Let's Talk About Death Over Dinner, an invitation and guide to life's most important conversation. You can call us at 800-933-5372. Michael, people who have lost a child, especially a child in childhood, find themselves sometimes in this really lonely place where everybody around them is uncomfortable talking about that loss. You met a woman who photographs dying children so their families will have keepsakes. Can you talk about what you learned from her and her work?
Yeah, the organization is called Soul Illumination. That's one word. And this work is, you know, I've got kids. I have a 10-year-old and an 18-year-old. This is the unthinkable. So it's not like I gleefully go into this terrain or this topic. But it's a reality for a lot of people. And Soul Illumination's work is to work with parents when they have a child that is, you know, dealing with a terminal diagnosis or a chronic diagnosis and most likely not going to make it. And to come and instead of neglecting them or putting a cone of silence around them and putting those families in a corner, she comes in as an artist, as a photographer, and takes pictures of the family and the child to say, even though this being, this soul, was only on the planet for a period of time, let me give you some beautiful way of remembering them. And so she takes beautiful pictures of these kids in their last stages and even, you know, after they've passed. And it really gives the parents the opportunity and permission to take some kind of ownership over that experience and their grief, and to have this remembrance that's really powerful, that someone would care enough about them to come in and do that work with them. And, you know, this became, you'd think, well, who would want that? Well, it turns out a lot of people, another 60 photographers in Seattle alone that are working with families. And they're all volunteer, and they create these beautiful remembrance boxes for the families. And, you know, people who have lost children, it's a daily, you know, if not a minute-by-minute part of their lives. And so we really have to ask ourselves is, you know, if we want to stay connected to people who have had tragic losses, like the loss of a child or a suicide close to them, if we want to stay deeply connected to them, then I believe we will need to let them know that we're there to talk about these things. And some people don't want to talk about it. I'm not saying that anybody who has lost a child or anybody that's been close to suicide or other tragic losses is just waiting for you to have the conversation. But there is a lot of people who want to have an acknowledgement that you see their pain and you see their suffering, and you have the courage to stand there next to them.
You say if we don't talk about people who have died by suicide, we don't often address the kind of trauma that can lead to suicide.
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing is, we know pretty clearly now that depression and suicidal thoughts, a lot of that comes from a sense of isolation, right? So, and a culture of isolation. And there's a lot of things isolating us. Politics isolates us. Our phones isolate us. Just how technologically involved our worlds are, the inability to have meaningful conversations over dinner. So there's a lot that isolates us. And if we don't start to address those that have been isolated by losing somebody from suicide, or somebody who has had an attempt or has dealt with suicidal ideation, if we continue to act like they're too much, or or to say that we can't step into that space with them, I think that we'll continue to see the crisis that we're currently in. I mean, suicide is on the rise. It's an epidemic in our country.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Lisa in Plano. Hi, Lisa.
Hello, Chris.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Hi, I really want to thank your guest. I'm sorry, I forgot your name. I really wanted to thank you about, you know, talking about this sort of thing, because something that you said a little while ago really hit home with me. My mother died last year of cancer, and I was her caregiver, but Dad was always, you know, in the house. I moved in with them to take care of her. And what they would do is they would talk to me individually, but they wouldn't talk to each other about what was going on, because Dad just kept saying, I can't accept it, I can't accept it. Well, Mom knew he couldn't, so she didn't really try to tell him anything. She would talk to me, and then after she passed, he kept saying, well, I wish we would have talked about this, or I wish you would have talked about that. And I said, Dad, you just kept telling her you couldn't accept it, so she couldn't really say anything to you.
Thanks so much for calling, Lisa. Sorry about your mom.
Yeah, Lisa. And thank you for being there for her. I mean, I think that, people are having this conversation in their heads. Everyone's talking about death. We know it. We're mortal. we may not be sharing that conversation that we're having in our heads with people, right? And so what you provided was there was enough openness, open-heartedness, generosity of spirit, or trust, any number of these things between you and your mom, that she felt comfortable sharing with you the most vulnerable parts of herself. And so, you know, when people say, hey, my parents won't talk about death, I say, well, what in you, instead of pointing the finger, it's like, what in us needs to change so the people that are already having the conversation in their heads feel comfortable sharing that with us.
What do we know about the training doctors receive to talk to their patients and families about death?
Yeah, well, a little too late. Death has been a real bad word in medicine. This is the thing that we're fighting against. They don't like to use it. Talk about euphemizing. And there is very few medical schools that are actually teaching about end of life. That's changing. It's increasing. There's nursing programs are a bit better because they tend to deal with the actual body and more than doctors do. But we're in the middle of a sea change, and I was able to host a dinner just about 3 weeks ago at the Cleveland Clinic, one of the most extraordinary medical organizations globally, but with all of their leaders, all of their executives and the heads of every department, and they're ready. So the Cleveland Clinic and Death Over Dinner are creating, in partnership with a few global hospitals and teaching colleges, one in Australia, one in Brazil, possibly one in Denmark. We're creating a medical edition of Death Over Dinner so that there is an opportunity for doctors, nurses, social workers, administrators to have these conversations, to have a ready curriculum and experience. We'll be working on getting every third-year medical student to also have a dinner is our big goal. I'm quite hopeful that there is a dramatic cultural shift that's going to be happening within our medical institutions, but also for all of us. Lisa, I want the culture to rise up so that people like Lisa's father don't feel so resistant, and I understand why they would.
Another question prompt from the book that I really love is, what is the most significant end-of-life experience you've been a part of? It's interesting because the experience of being with somebody as they die is something we don't forget, and it's not universally a bad experience, which maybe we can't imagine before we have had that experience.
Yeah, if we don't tell these stories, if we don't have an opportunity to tell these stories, we go to a default setting about what death and dying is like. I take some issue with this, the new buzz phrase, the good death movement. I love all of the work that it's doing, but I think it needs another name because it has a value statement on death. What if my parent had a bad death? Am I not part of the movement? What makes a good death? But what I'm more interested in, the good or bad, is the fact that people start sharing these stories. So when they are developing their own relationship to their own death or preparing for the fact that they may lose a parent or they're going to lose a parent at some point, that they are pulling from a body of narrative, a body of story that's more than what you find in popular culture or in movies or in books, that you can have an informed relationship to what end of life is really like, because a lot of it is deep connection, deep spiritual connection for people. A lot of times it's quite peaceful. A lot of times a lot of things get healed at the end for people. And then sometimes there's just, deaths that don't go well. Who's to make that decision? What is a good death and a bad death?
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Do you think on a regular basis, a daily basis, about the reality that you are going to die? And do you think that's because of this work or because of who you are?
Well, now I don't have a choice. I've kind of created, or it's happened to me. Like I said earlier, this project started with a hunch, but a very humble project that now there have been over 200,000 death dinners, which means that we're probably near a million people who've had these experiences. And then with the book now in people's hands, you know, if I wanted to have a day where I don't think about death, I'm going to have to go somewhere and unplug. I like identifying my edges. I find that vitality for me and excitement in life and also peace comes from seeing where I'm having a hard time, where I'm scared, where I have an edge, and then going towards it. I also do it with conflict in my life. I've trained myself to not avoid, but think about, like, do I feel that there's a conflict with a coworker or with a a loved one, and turning towards it and addressing it, because then I find that the relationship can hit an equilibrium, can hit kind of like a really nice homeostasis, a good feel good, as opposed to be in some sort of tense space. So that's kind of who I am. And I love going after these big, impossible problems as well.
It does change the way you live your life if you remain aware that you won't live forever.
Yeah. I mean, it can't not. The life is given meaning by the fact that it ends. It is defined by the fact that it's finite. Love, would we love the same if we were immortal? It would be different. I'm not saying that it wouldn't exist. But there, you know, in every breath that we take, like there is the fact that that breath is going to stop at some point. But I think it does, it isn't that meditating on our impermanence equals the same thing for every person. It is that through thinking about our impermanence, thinking about our mortality, we get to know ourselves better. Getting to know oneself is, has been part of every religion, every wisdom tradition since time began, is to really understand what we're doing here and ask the big questions. What's my purpose? Why am I on this planet? Or how do I really take care of my loved ones or make sure that I'm expressing my love to them? How do I make sure I'm doing the job I want to be doing? Or what do I want to do on Saturday? Like, who am I? So these things are forced through this, this great mirror of a question that is around death.
Michael Hebb is founder of Death Over Dinner and the organization Convivium. His book is called Let's Talk About Death Over Dinner, an invitation and guide to life's most important conversation. Michael, it's been really interesting, and I so appreciate you making time for us. Thanks.
Oh, what an honor and what a pleasure.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The Twitter handle is @KERAThink. Subscribe to the podcast using your favorite podcast app and learn about what we have coming up on the show on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.